guard.
These guys went to get chairs? That's where they went? Okay, let's try to begin. I doubt I'm going to get much louder than this, so if you can, you know, maybe move up a drop, it might be helpful. But if everybody's quiet, you should be able to hear without a problem. I'm really just going to spend the next couple of minutes trying to move a little bit deeper and reiterate some of the things that we heard about 24 hours ago from Rabbi Leibowitz and some of the things we just heard a minute ago from Ruth Twersky. They said it better than I could, but I make no apologies for being a little bit repetitive from the things we've heard before, because it seems that even after our time together, the 5 weeks we've been able to spend together learning, we can't really say it quite enough times. We're going to hear a lot over the next few days, questions about what we gained out of the summer and how successful a summer it was, how great a summer it was. And that's a question that many of us, whether we are Rabbeim or Madrichim or the NCSYers themselves, it's a question that it's appropriate for us to ask ourselves and to discuss as often as possible. And I'm going to give you my two cents about it. I think, as Rav Twersky just alluded to in the Beis Medrash not 5 minutes ago, I think it boils down to some things that are extraordinarily simple. About a decade ago, when I was teaching in Reshit Yerushalayim, so there was a guy who was head of the class. He was put together, and he was, you know, he was a mensch, and he was very popular. He was a great ball player, and he was fantastic in learning also. He's in all the top shiurim, and he was learning incredible number of hours. And I was very, very startled when I sat down with him about 3 months into the year, and I asked him how his year was going, and he told me it was going absolutely terribly. He said he thought it was terrible that he was in yeshiva. He thought he was wasting his time, and he thought he was a complete failure. Now, there is such a phenomenon when a person pushes themselves too hard and they're overly perfectionist, and we don't always know how great we are. And I assumed it was going to be that kind of conversation. Try to tell them, listen, relax, and don't be so hard on yourself, and you're really great, and you're really wonderful, and you're really doing all these things. But luckily, I let him talk a little bit more, and I realized that he was 100% correct. He said, I didn't come here to pick up learning skills, and I didn't come here to have a minyan three times a day. I was doing all of those things before I got the yeshiva, and I likely will continue to do those things for the foreseeable future. But I know that behind my back, I know because I've heard it, and I know because I've looked in the mirror and witnessed it for myself, I know that the people closest to me think that I'm a jerk. I know that I speak negatively about people from time to time. I know that nobody, even though I'm one of the most talented ball players in the yeshiva, and I was one of the most talented ball players in my high school, and I was one of the most talented ball players in the yeshiva league, I know no one really enjoys playing with me. Nobody has a good time. Yes, they like winning, and yes, they like being on the team that, you know, moves on in the playoffs, but nobody ever gets that great feeling of camaraderie, of teamwork, because I'm a jerk on the court. And I came here with one goal and one goal only, and that was to be a little bit less of a jerk. I wasn't looking for a transformation, and I wasn't looking to flip out. I just set for myself the goal, maybe through some of the things that I was learning, maybe through some of the rabbeim that I would have, I'd be a little bit less of a jerk. I'd be a little bit better of a person in my interactions, that people would say about me, not that I'm put together, and not that I'm good looking, and not that I'm funny, and not that I'm good at ball, and not that I'm cool, and not that I'm even a great guy, but people would say it about me that I'm a nice person, would say about me that I care about others. That's what I was hoping to get out of yeshiva, and I didn't get that. And it's 3 months, and I don't feel myself a drop nicer, a drop better, and therefore I think I'm wasting my time, I think that I'm a failure. And all I told him was that he's correct. All I told him was that he's correct, and maybe to be a little bit patient. And if you really care about those things, then maybe you'll get the results that you're looking for before too long. It is not an exaggeration to say that what we have tried to accomplish this summer boils down to, as we heard from Rav Tversky moments ago, it boils down to, if it could boil down to anything, are we better people? Are we nicer friends? Are we better siblings than we were when we got on the plane at the beginning of July? Did all of our experiences, and we could talk about love of Eretz Yisrael, and we could speak about making new friends, and we could talk about the extraordinary accomplishments that people have had in learning, but has it made us into better people? Has it made us into nicer people? And will people say about us, not that we're the proverbial great guy, which means next to nothing, a discussion for a different time, not that we're good at this or that we've accomplished that, but will people say about us when they talk about us, and for whatever it's worth, for good or for bad, it's probably mostly bad, but people will talk about us. And there'll always be people in our circle of friends who describe us. And will they describe us the way they describe the truly righteous and the truly noble? Or will they say that we're average at best and really lousy at worst? Will they say that we're just not nice people? Sure, he learns, and sure, he davens, and sure, he does all sorts of other things outside the base medrash, but a nice person, he isn't. That is a failure of our experience here. It's nothing less than that. A day ago, we read for the second time this year, the third time this year, counting Shavuos, we read about the Aseret HaDibros. You're all aware of the fact that the Aseret HaDibros are split up into two categories, that there are two sides to the Aseret HaDibros, and there are two components to make up all of our Jewish identities. There is the side that we refer to as Bein Adam L'Makom, the things that relate, the way in which we relate to God, the brachos we make, so many of the mitzvos that we do, so much of the learning that we have, and also a side that says Bein Adam L'Chaveiro, not to steal and not to murder, not to be jealous, as some of us spoke about yesterday, the side that deals primarily with the way in which we interact with other people. Now I'm going to ask you a very important question, and it's one of the most significant Torahs we're going to share in our few minutes here tonight. So think about it for a minute before you respond in your own mind. But I'm going to ask everybody to kind of participate and think about it, because I'll probably show you something you haven't thought about before in just a couple of minutes. So listen to it carefully. What's the exact nature between the relationship of Bein Adam L'Makom and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro? Why is it, and how does it work, that a fully developed religious personality excels at both sides of the Aseret HaDibros? That a fully developed Jew, a fully developed religious personality, has the ability to be excellent in Bein Adam L'Makom and Bein Adam L'Chaveiro? How does that work exactly? Because I'll strengthen the question and give slightly more food for thought. There is such a thing called multitasking. It's really very prominent in our world today. There are very few of us who do at any given time only one thing. As I'm speaking right now, not a great number of you, but a few of you are actually doing something else while I'm speaking right now. I'm not even offended. I'm certainly not surprised. That's kind of the way of the world. We're always doing multiple things at once. It's very rare to excel at multiple things at once, at least when they don't share a common root. If I told you that LeBron James was bored of playing basketball and was seriously contemplating playing tight end for the Browns, which has been spoken about for his entire career, you wouldn't be overly shocked. You might think it's cool, certainly might think it's interesting. We might speculate on how good a tight end LeBron James could be. But the notion that LeBron James could be an all-pro in multiple sports, it's not shocking to anybody. A great athlete, that common core, is going to be able to do multiple things at once. If we had more time, we'd go through the examples of it. But Julius Peppers was a power forward for University of North Carolina while he was playing defensive end for the football team. Tony Gonzalez was a power forward for Jason Kidd at Cal before he became the greatest tight end. It's possible. If you're 6'8 or 7'1 and you're really, really athletic, there are multiple things that you can do, and it makes sense that you be excellent at a bunch of that. But if I were to tell you that LeBron James or Steph Curry playing golf, another example, like any of you following the news knew he did, who knew that he'd be really good at golf? We knew he'd be really good at golf. Because although golf is a quasi-sport and doesn't involve the same athletic talents that maybe basketball and football do, it's not totally shocking that a person of the competitive nature, hand-eye coordination of Steph Curry is good at more things in the world of sports besides just basketball. But if I told you that Steph Curry or LeBron James or Julius Peppers or Tony Gonzalez were contemplating retirement because they're really, really talented at the violin, or they were contemplating retirement because they're unbelievable at playing the cello, we'd be a little bit more surprised, because those are skills that don't share a common core and don't have so much to do with each other. So how does it happen? I'll ask you a simple question, and then we'll go back to our original question. We know that certain people in our history, certain people in Tanakh, have extraordinary characteristics. And there's a man that everybody in this room knows. He is our forefather and our preeminent forefather. His name is Avram Avinu. Now, Avram Avinu has two claims of fame to his name. One of them corresponds to one side of the Luchos, and the other one corresponds to the other side of the Luchos. Avram Avinu somehow, some way, did two extraordinary things in his life. If I say to you, Avram Avinu, so what's the first thing that comes to mind? So you don't have to shout it out, because it would be confusing. Half of the room would shout out, probably a little bit more than half, because it's what's emphasized in pre-1A and it stays with us for a long time. Half the room, or a little more than half the room, would shout out that Avram Avinu was known for Gemilas Chasadim, for the tent that was open for four sides, for reaching out and caring about all Jews, for being an exceptionally nice person. But the other half of the room weren't thinking that at all. And Avram Avinu, when he wasn't busy visiting sick people, and when he wasn't opening up his tent to four sides, he found the time to found monotheistic religions. He found the time to discover God while he was visiting sick people and going to do Nicham Avelim and console mourners and all the other acts of chesed and hachnasas orchim that he was doing. Oh, by the way, while he was the best power forward of all time, he also figured out how to be an unbelievable violinist. That doesn't happen in life. That doesn't happen in the real world. The only way that Avram Avinu excels at both of these areas is if one of them emanates from the other. If a person's relationship with God somehow is connected fundamentally to his relationship with other people. And therefore I ask you the question, and I will surprise you with the answer. I ask you the question, how is it possible? What does it mean that they are connected to each other? After all, what I believe and the way that I daven is one aspect of my personality, and the way I act in the dorm at night and the types of friends that I have and the way I treat other people is a completely different aspect of our personality. And we have been taught something which is unquestionably true, but it's only a partial truth. We have been taught that the answer to that question is very simple, and Rav Tversky quoted this as well just a few minutes ago. To believe in God and to serve God is to mean by definition that we are better people and nicer to God's other creatures. The more I believe in God, the better person I am going to be. So therefore, when I start from a platform, when I start from a foundation of genuine, strong belief in God, I end up with being a better and nicer person. If I came here not knowing what my goals were going to be, and I followed the schedule, and I found myself learning more Gemara Menachos, and learning more Mesilas Yesharim, and spending more time with my Madrich than I ever thought that I would. And I hang out for all sorts of hours in the Beis Medrash. There's a system that says that as I develop my Bein Adam L'Makom, and as I develop in learning, and as I come closer to God, it's going to make me into a nicer person. I'm going to suggest to you before we leave in a few minutes that not only that is true for sure, and that's supposed to be true and it better be true, but the opposite is true as well, and you've probably never heard such a suggestion. The more I learn how to relate to others, the easier time I am going to have with something that behind closed doors, more than a few of us in this room struggle with from time to time, which is how do I relate to God and how do I discover Him in a very, very confusing world. Hold that thought for a minute and let's go full steam ahead into what we came here to do, both tonight in this room and this summer on NCSY Kollel as a whole. Listen to me carefully. There are a number of words that operate, a number of words in the English language, which we all know, but if we were pushed to, if we were challenged to translate them, we'd have a very, very difficult time doing it. I'll give you a great example, and then I'll give you the example that I want to talk about. A great example of that is the word cute, especially as it's applied to a young child or a baby. You see a baby or you see a three-year-old kid and you say, oh my God, that kid is so cute. What do you mean by that word? What's the definition of cuteness? You're going to say right away some level of attractiveness or some level of endearment. That gets very creepy very, very quickly and very inappropriate. So what do you mean by the word? We all know what it means. It's not a wrong word to use, but many of us would have a very, very difficult time defining exactly what that word means. There's a similar word, and you could try later if you want, or you could look it up on an online dictionary and Google it and see what you come up with and share it with the rest of the group. But there's a similar word almost on the opposite end of the spectrum that we use all the time. We all know what it means, but yet we have a very difficult time defining exactly what that word means. That word is mature. We're at a stage in life where we are constantly being defined by our parents, our siblings, our friends, our teachers, all people around us, as how mature we are. A 14 or 15 or 16 or 17-year-old is being told, that's a compliment. He's a very mature young man. As opposed to a person of that age or perhaps even older, one of the stronger insults we would give such a person, that's a very immature type of person. That's a person who is not, he's very immature. What does that mean? How do you define those things? So on the simplest level, on a biological, physiological level, mature can be used to describe a fruit. Mature can be described a bond or a stock or an investment a person makes. We use that word that something matures. It means it reaches its fullest growth and its fullest potential. All mature means, and we could use this in a body type of sense, all mature means is that I am fully grown, and all immature means that I am not fully grown. But there's no way that that's the extent of what we mean when we describe a person's personality or when we describe a person's characteristics as being mature or immature. What do we mean when we describe mature or immature? One of the more sophisticated answers that people will give to that question is that mature or immature is defined by level of responsibility. If I would trust you with my car, if I would trust you with my children, you're probably a mature person. If you can't be trusted, and halacha uses this to determine when a person under the age of bar mitzvah might have to, as part of chinuch, be obligated to do certain things, if we could trust you with a pair of tefillin, you should wear them. If you understand what to do with a lulav, you should shake it. Responsibility is a decent start and a decent definition. But I want to give you a better definition that actually has the potential to impact all of us in a very, very deep and a significant way. Mature and immature, if we want to fully understand them, we can begin to look at what we would all agree is the most immature person we've ever met in our lives. The least mature creature on earth. Now, many of us might start pointing fingers around the room, and we're with a guy at 3 o'clock in the morning and say, I know that guy. I know the least mature person on earth. It's a 16-year-old who still laughs at bathroom humor. It's a guy who does... That's not the least mature person we know. We know, all of us, that mature and immature has something to do with growth. And we know that we are at that type of age where we are hovering between maturity and immaturity. So if we follow that timeline a little bit further, we would all understand and we would all determine that the least mature person in the world is an infant, is a baby, is a child that's only a few days old. We never call them that. You're never going to go back to the cute example. You're never going to go to a baby of 2 years old. Oh my God, that kid is so immature. Of course he's immature. He's 3 weeks old. But it's a fact, of course, that he is, that the three-week-old baby is the most immature creature on earth. If I, as a 16-year-old who doesn't act like a 16-year-old, is somewhat immature, then I, as a 16-month-old, am very immature. I'm not nearly, unless you're going to define immaturity as being younger or acting younger than I am supposed to be, in which case the 16-year-old may be right on target. That's not a very fair definition, though. If as a 16-year-old who is not up to the level of growth that he is supposed to be, I am immature, then as a 16-month-year-old, I'm even less mature. What defines a 16-month-old? What defines a young child and even a baby as being so immature? Again, we could go physiological and say he doesn't grow facial hair unless it's some kind of weird movie. He doesn't grow facial hair and he doesn't have, you know, developed arms and limbs and he can't even stand on his own 2 feet. Maybe on a physiological, we'll say as this human body at 16 months is very immature. But maybe we could say something else as well. There are certain conditions, there are certain mindsets that define what it means to be a baby. And I don't mean a baby in a derogatory way to anybody in this room. We'll get to that in a minute. But there are certain mindsets, certain conditions that define what it means to be a baby that we could all readily identify. Psychologists try desperately to figure out what babies think, what goes through a baby's mind, and there are all sorts of experiments to figure this out. If you take AP Psych, or if you take any basic classes in human psychology, you'll know that it's a big thing about how the mind develops, how the mind works, and what runs through the mind of a baby when the baby is very young. But one thing everybody agrees on, there are certain things that we know for a fact never run through the mind of the baby and can't run through the mind of a baby. If I have a 16-month-old, I had six of them, B'li'ai and Hara, at different points in their lives. If I have a 16-month-old child in the room down the hall from where my wife and I sleep, we are certain that at no point in time does that 16-month-year-old have the 16-month-old have the following thought process go through his mind. At no point does he say himself, okay, I got a serious issue going on in my diaper right now. I need a lot of help. However, when I went to sleep tonight, I saw the look on my mother's face. She looked extremely, extremely tired. She really looked like she's had a rough day. I'm pretty sure that the best gift I can give my mom is a good night's sleep. I'm going to take one for the team. The diaper's bad, but it's not the end of the world. I'll be able to withstand the diaper, look at my watch, which doesn't exist. About 6 a.m., I'll start crying out after she's gotten another couple of hours. A baby is not capable of any part of that thought process, and the fact that a baby can't keep time is the least significant part of what the baby is incapable of doing. The baby is incapable of contemplating for an instant what is going on down the hall or what anybody else is thinking or feeling. And that, my friends, defines the immaturity of a baby or of an infant. A baby is not capable on any level of having that thought. You know that a baby, virtually all babies that have ever crawled on this earth, they love as a game, they love the game of peekaboo. Now, if you think about it, this is a little bit of an insult to our infancy and to babies' intelligence. As games go, it's fairly lousy. As games go, it's not really that exciting at all. The hands in front of the eyes and then they go. Hands in front of the eyes and then they go. Like you could do it for hours and the baby's giggling away and it's having the time of its life. You know why that is? There's something amazingly deep that goes on in the human mind when that happens. A baby has something, there's a fancy word for it called object constancy. It means even when I don't see it, I know that it exists. I have the sensitivity to it. Do you know that when you go to a baby and you cover your eyes or the baby's eyes for a moment, you are a greater magician than Harry Houdini? You're a greater magician than David Blaine. You're a greater magician than any performer has ever lived. You are actually on this incredible stage with this remarkably stupid audience. You are able to disappear and appear at a moment's notice. The baby is not wired to understand that you exist for a moment, that you exist for a second, that he cannot see you. You know why babies, let's go one step further. You know why babies love the roller coaster ride of being picked up high and then being brought down low again? Because when a baby is picked up high, he sees things that he doesn't know exist before. When you're a baby and you're below the level of the couch, so all your world is defined by that couch. There is no world behind the couch. You're Christopher Columbus discovering a new world when you pick a baby up higher than high. Oh my gosh, I totally forgot and did not know that that world existed beyond the couch that existed a minute. It's a brand new perspective on life. Those things did not exist, not for a minute. Babies have the worst kind of separation anxiety, and we make fun of them for it a little bit. Grow up and be a man. We might not say that to a 16-month-old, but we think it sometimes. The baby's crying like going nuts when the mom drops him off at a playgroup or the mom drops him off at preschool. Separation anxiety. Why does a baby have separation anxiety? Because the mom is doing something quite horrible. A baby is incapable of contemplating the fact that while he is sipping his apple juice and eating animal crackers at 10 in the morning, his mom is elsewhere in the world doing something else. The baby is living in the most terrifying universe possible for a baby. The baby is living in a world, in a universe where mom no longer exists. That's worthy of a tear or two. That's scary to an infant. That's a terrible, terrible thing for a baby to live with. And it's okay for a baby at 16 months old to grapple with those kinds of challenges and to learn about the world. It is a lot less okay for an adult at 16 years old to grapple with the same challenges. For an adult to be so wrapped up in his own world that nothing exists beyond what he sees in front of them right there. That nothing exists beyond his own need. It's perfectly fine. I don't expect more from my 16-month-old child to be cared only about what's in his own diaper and only about how hungry he is, and there really is nobody else in the world that matters or cares to him. But it's a lot less okay when a 16-year-old is engaging in very, very similar types of behaviors. You've all gotten to know, many of you went through what I'm about to describe in a minute. Rabbi Kamenetsky is the principal of DRS. He also happens to be my brother-in-law. He's married to my sister. We've spoken about a lot of these things many, many times. And Rabbi Kamenetsky is the principal in DRS. Again, you could raise your hand a minute if this was you a few years ago, but he has to do a whole lot of 8th grade high school interviews, again, including so many of the people in the room. And he's confessed to me, I don't think he'll be too angry for my reveal right now, that's not his absolute favorite part of the job. There are only so many times you can listen to an 8th grader not know how to read a Gemara and Bava Metzia, you know, the same lines over and over again, before you want to kill yourself. There are only so many times you're not going to make fun of Rabbi Kamenetsky for sometimes falling asleep. I'd like to see you try it before you, before you do it. It's not an exhilarating experience to interview on one day 60 8th graders. And he says to me that the worst part about it, he doesn't hate it, he loves it because he's Rabbi Kamenetsky, but the worst part about it, if there is a bad part about it, the worst part about it is that it's so unnecessary. Placement for a Gemara Shir, sure, we could do that quickly. But Rabbi Kamenetsky always says, if we really wanted to know about any 8th grader who's applying to DRS, don't care where he's coming from, who his parents are. If we really wanted to understand about 8th graders, I need, says Rabbi Kamenetsky, I need about 3 minutes, maybe four. A minute and a half to 2 minutes, we'll go daven mincha, and I'll just see the way he holds a sitter. I'll just see the way that he davens, and then we'll go across the little alleyway over there. We'll go over the bridge into the gym, and I'll watch him play ball for 2 minutes. Not going to know if he has a right or a left. I'm not going to know whether he's making JV in 2 minutes necessarily. But I'll know what type of person he is. I'll know his type of character. I'll know how he struts. I know how he conducts himself. And of course, the Gemara says something. You can tell everything you want to know about a person from certain key moments in their lives. And Rabbi Kamenetsky said it to me many times. Let's stop the whole interview process. Let me see 2 minutes of mincha, 2 minutes of the way he holds a sitter, 2 minutes of the way he davens, and 2 minutes of the way he plays ball, and I'll know everything else about the person that I need to know. And I always add to that that I am not nearly as smart as Rabbi Kamenetsky. I need 6 minutes. I need 2 minutes for mincha. I need 2 minutes for ball. And I need, and you're going to excuse me for saying it, but I need 2 minutes at 11:30 on a Friday night in Teaneck, New Jersey, or in Pico Robertson. 2 minutes to see the way he walks out of his... I don't care if he was drinking at his friend's house. I don't care if he was learning Gemara with his Rebbe. I want to see the way he walks through the streets at 11 o'clock at night just for 2 minutes. Is he a baby? Is he a mature person? Is he a child? Or is he an adult? An adult and a mature person and a great person, gentlemen, at that moment is cognizant of the fact that on those streets live people. And in those houses that we can't see inside of, there is almost certainly at least one mother who has spent the past 3 hours trying to put her kid to sleep. He may have a small fever. He may be afraid of the dark on a Friday night. But he's in that house right there. He's in that house and he's trying to sleep. And I'm walking out of my friend's house, exhilarated from a tish. Let's talk best case scenario. Not drunk from an open house. I'm exhilarated from something that was spiritually uplifting. And that house, that person, simply does not exist because I cannot see it. And you can know everything you need to know about the nature of a person by his ability to be sensitive to and to take in the fact that a person other than what we can see in front of us exists or doesn't exist. If you're the type of person who would go over to a friend who is ill or go over to a friend who is dying to be able to make it to chakras on time, and you think it's cool or funny to wake that person up, to shake them, then I have nothing to tell you tonight. You're just an unpleasant person. You're just an underdeveloped and insensitive soul. But I doubt there are more than two people, and there may be zero people in this room who would do such a thing, who would think it's cool or a prank to go to a person at 12:30 a.m. and to actively shake them and wake them up, to yell in their ear, to prevent them from sleeping because we find that to be entertaining. I don't believe there are more than two people, and I'll put my money on zero. I'll put my chips on a grand total of zero people who would do that actively. That's such a level of depravity. That's such a level of insensitivity. It almost defies words. But I'll tell you what we do have in this room. We've got about 100 people. And don't look around at your friend. Only look at yourself. We've got 100 people who will do the exact same thing out of ignorance and out of immaturity. That person who is trying to sleep, I would never wake him up if I knew he was there. But when I'm playing poker with my friends, he doesn't exist. When I get into a water fight around the dorm, there's nobody else in the world. I'm a baby in a crib with a dirty diaper, and nothing else in the world matters to me. Nothing else makes a difference whatsoever. And that's not a way that anybody could or should lead their lives. Water bottles and greatness, you want to know what that's about? Water bottle and greatness is not a catchy title for a description. Do you know the Chilul Hashem that so many of us have created? I believe, and I'm telling you this straight out, I believe it's a moral failing if a person can chug a drink of water and then pretend like he's an NBA star and throw it just on the ground like that. How hard is it to throw out a water bottle when we're done? And what's the psychology? What's the mentality that leaves, we average about, literally, without exaggeration, we average about 200 water bottles on the floor an afternoon on NCSY Colo. There are a lot of stats that I'm really, really proud of. There are a lot of things that we do better than almost anybody else in the world, and this is an amazing collection of people. That's not a stat that's going on any brochure anytime soon. That's not a stat that makes me feel great about the Torah that we've learned here this summer. What's the psychology? Am I trying to make Moshav Beit Meir incredibly ugly? Am I trying to get back at them because of the fact that I don't have enough hot water on a Friday afternoon and this is my revenge that I'm going to throw a water bottle there? Am I trying to say I understand? Do you know that there are people on this staff while we're either sleeping in the morning or learning Torah in the Beis Medrash? Do you know there are people in the hot sun who go out every single day and clean up our water bottles from the day before? And if you're crazy enough to think that I paid $8,000 for the summer, so I've earned that type of maid service, you really should leave right now. There are no words to describe how off that is as a mentality that somebody needs to clean up after us all the time. So what is the mentality? We're not such terrible people. We're not such evil people. We're fundamentally insensitive people sometimes. Because those people who, until I just described it to you, you wouldn't have known that they even exist, those people don't exist. The basketball court and its filth does not exist the moment I leave it. That's the mentality of a 16-month-old person. Not the mentality of a Ben Torah, not the mentality of any mature, decent, and certainly not the mentality of any great individual or any great person. There is a part of the Torah that we've read a number of times over the past few weeks. It's a bizarre type of description of something we don't have nowadays called an ir miklat. You kill somebody accidentally, so you run away to a city of refuge. And then if that wasn't weird enough, you stay in the city of refuge until the Kohen Gadol dies. It's a strange association. And all of the commentators, and even the Gemara itself, they point out, you know why you wait until the Kohen Gadol dies? Kohen Gadol is a big high priest. He's in charge of things. Something is broken with the world when you have a horeg b'shogeg, a person who kills accidentally. What's broken about a person who kills accidentally? Kills on purpose, I totally understand. Kill up their murderers running around Moshav Beit Meir, Houston, we have a problem. That's a big mistake. But what's so terrible about an accident? What's so terrible about an axe flying off its handle and killing somebody? It's terrible. It's a lousy outcome, but it's kind of not my fault. It's not that big a deal. So the truth is, my whole life I've been bothered by that. And I always thought that the answer was that it has to do with sanctity of life. There are certain basic values that we have as Jews. Quality of life and sanctity of life. Things that define us as Jews and as people. And it's good to believe in those things. And we miss the message so often about them. 30 seconds of a parenthetical thought, because we're almost at the end and I want to finish to the main point. But the parenthetical thought is, you ask yourself, after years and years of Jewish education, or even after 5 weeks at NCSY Kollel, what have we learned and what have we picked up on? So one of the things we should learn and pick up on is quality of life, is sanctity of life. One of the questions that I ask myself as an amateur educator, as a person who tries to teach people all of the time. If you sit on NCSY Kollel and then you go for your driver's test and you go for your driver's license later on in your junior year, are we more likely as NCSY Kollel statistically to text and drive? Are we more likely to speed or not speed? Those are really good questions that we don't ask often enough. And it has to do with the impact of Torah in our lives. If you listen to Kriyas HaTorah when they read about the Ir Miklat, and you see the way the Torah values and sanctifies life, then we're meant to internalize that and think about that before we put the keys into the ignition of the car and before we get into a killing machine irresponsibly. And I'd like to think that you spend the summer at NCSY Kollel, you become a better and safer driver because of it. Okay, that's what I always thought my whole life. And a few weeks ago, I heard an insight that was so beautiful and so simple. And it said, you know what the problem is with a person who kills accidentally? It's not just the horeg b'shogeg, not just that he killed accidentally and doesn't have a proper respect for life. You know what the problem is? The problem is that he's locked into such a narrow vision of the world. When you hammer like that, and the axe is a little bit loose from the handle, you're not thinking about any of the other people. You're not thinking about anybody else who's there. It's your world and your crib, and I don't mean that in a good way. And that's all that exists around us. And that's a terrible way to live. There's nobody but else but us that is there. There's nobody else but us in the world. And that's a terrible way to live. The Kohen Gadol is meant to fix educationally that misconception. The Kohen Gadol is supposed to teach us to operate in a world where other things exist and need to be brought into the fold. where I have to chop down a tree and consider how does chopping down a tree impact other people around me. And the more that we're caught up in our own lives, in our own type of sensitivities, in our own type of world, and not sensitive to the world around us, the worse people that we are. You know what the relationship is between mitzvos ben adam l'chaveru and mitzvos ben adam l'makom. You know what the single biggest challenge in a world of confusion and rampant atheism and pursuit of pleasure and all of the things that distract us from service of God. You know what the single biggest reason, in my humble opinion, why so many of our friends and so many of us struggle with belief in God? Because God is not the first thing that we don't believe in. Because when I walk into a room, if I can't see you, how on earth am I ever going to see God? If I am the type of person who is trained to have antenna, if I'm the type of person who's trained to have exceptional sensitivity, if I could walk in a room or walk to my dorm at night and know that behind the walls there is something I can't see, so first of all, I become a better person, and you know what else I become? I become a person who's got a shot at davening the next morning and at believing in God. Because as soon as I live in a world where I see things beyond what is in right in front of me, as soon as I see in a world where I could imagine when I walk out of that house 11:30 on Friday night that there is a baby that just went to sleep and I'm doing the evil act of waking it up in the pursuit of absolutely nothing, for no gain and no purpose, the cost of lowering the volume of my voice would make up, but everybody's doing it, and what difference does it make? The fact that I am cognizant that that baby may very well exist on the other side of a wall that I cannot see through, not only makes me into a better person, but it trains me and gives me a shot to believe in God. Phil Collins was a big musician in the 80s, part of the band Genesis, and then he struck out on his own. He used to be an urban legend that he was a total anti-Semite. Almost certainly not true. But he's a very, very good songwriter. One of his more popular songs is about poverty in the world. It's called Another Day in Paradise. It's about the obliviousness of people in the world. Oh, says the refrain, oh, don't think twice. It's just another day in paradise. I'm doing what I'm doing. Don't think about what's going on in the room down the hall. Don't think about what's going on the court where I left the bottle. Don't think about anybody else. Just think once and briefly at that, and it's another day in paradise. Greatness is defined, to borrow from a parallel camp, greatness is defined for us as Rosh Gadol, as the Kohen Gadol, of being able to think about multiple things at once, of being able to take in and be sensitive to so much of the world around us. And I end with what I began, simply by stressing that if we can improve in this characteristic just a little bit, if we're a drop more sensitive to the things that are around us, the way that we say thank you to other people, there's such a way, sometimes the worst thing that happens to us is that we're trained properly in etiquette, so that when I get something, I say thank you, but I don't really appreciate where it is or where it came from. I don't really appreciate what went into, what was going on that impacts my world when I wasn't looking or at a different time. If we get a drop better at that sensitivity, we will truly have accomplished something amazing this summer, and we'll be well on our way to true greatness. If we don't, and we do all of the other stuff, and we've got all of the learning and all the relationships, but we're still stuck in our cribs, if we're still stuck in our immaturity, we're still stuck in our own worlds, then we have to ask ourselves, how much did we truly accomplish, and did we get what we came for 100%? You have such amazing role models in your Rabbeim and your Madrichim. They sacrifice for others to such an extraordinary degree. They see a world that is so far beyond what we see right in front of us all the time. I hope that we collectively have the strength to take advantage of their leadership and of what they model for us. And I hope that we can think about some of these things throughout the rest of this Le'el Yun and the rest of our last week together to again to begin to approach the truest and best part of greatness that any of us could muster. Rabbi Israeli is going to be continuing in here and describing the rest of the shiurim options that exist on the place.
There are three options right now. Rabbi Israeli, you're going to be beginning in 3 minutes. Rabbi Israeli, you're going to be beginning in 45 minutes. Rabbi Israeli, you're going to be beginning in 45 minutes.